Colleagues, welcome back to the office and welcome to our presentation for today. So happy that you've joined us and for our final discussion on case studies in fraud and technology controls, part four, part quattro. In this series, we have been looking and examining at different aspects of fraud and internal controls inside of our organization. We started this series with taking a look at the Report to the Nations, a biannual report, that's put together by the Association of Certified Fraud Examiners that looks at fraud in America today. Well, not just in America, but a little bit internationally as well. And unfortunately, fraud is just one of those things. It's pervasive. It's everywhere. It affects all different types of organizations, big and small. It affects tech companies, manufacturing firms, professional service organizations, you name it. And we looked at that and we tried to understand essentially what the heck was going on and what it was looking like in America today and also kind of around the world. Then from there, we took a look at some different case studies. We looked at the cases of Elizabeth Mulders. We looked at the case of Dixon, Illinois. We looked at the case of Matthews International and others. Some recent examples of what the heck is going on that we could essentially learn from for seeing what has occurred and what we could potentially do to prevent this from happening inside of our organizations. In our most recent iteration of the course, what we looked at is we looked at IT general controls. So much of accounting now, especially on the audit side of this, is about testing controls and systems. And if you think about it, so much of IT work and accounting work now is systems. I mean, there's not a business today that is not meaningfully using technology in some capacity, whether it be your point of sale system, your HR system, your payroll system, or more. And through that discussion, we learned the importance of essentially how general controls are the backbone of what we need to do to build trust inside of our organizations. Now, today, we're going to go ahead and continue that discussion, and we're going to continue to talk through some of the IT general controls. Specifically, we'll talk about how we can test this for operations, for programs, for program development, and more. We'll also talk about the top 10 IT general control deficiencies. For example, not terminating employees after they've left, not having critical systems backed up and made available if they don't happen to be online when a user needs them. And then we're going to dive into our application controls, talking about how we could design a system for evaluating controls, processing changes, creating a catalog of different controls as well. And we'll also talk about a little bit with respect to some of the stuff that's on the horizon, some future tech around controls. For example, implementing tools such as artificial intelligence, deep learning, AI, and other can be incredibly helpful with respect to keeping an eye on our systems, even if we're not awake. So there's so much more data being processed in 2021 and 2022 and going forward that any sort of competitive advantage we can get over the fraudsters using technology would be a welcomed thing for our organization. So all that and more, and if you haven't checked out our previous iterations of this course, parts 1, 2, and 3, please go ahead and check those out. As always with our podcast, it is available to you free, F-R-E-E, through YouTube, Facebook, or if you'd like, check out cpetoday.com, and you can go ahead and watch them there. Now, if you would like, if you're a financial professional, remember, you can earn credits for watching or listening to today. Head on over to cpetoday.com and after watching or listening, take a short 5-question quiz and you will earn your credits. You'll be well on your way for maintaining your professional license. So please, if you'd like to support the channel, if you're looking to get your education, this is a great way of making sure that we can continue to put out great high quality content for you. So we're going to get started here, and I will join you back at the end of our presentation for some review questions and to wrap up our series. Thank you so much for being here, and I will see you here shortly. Thank you. So looking through our general controls, again, we've got a couple ones that we should be familiar with: access to programs and data, program changes, program development, and operations. So let's take a look at some examples of this. Access to programs and data. What are our objectives? Well, access to programs and data should be restricted to only authorized individuals based off of what their job requirements are. Well, what's the risk if we don't do this? Well, unauthorized access could lead to improper changes, destruction of data, disclosure to unauthorized people. What can we do to make this happen? Well, username and passwords, logical access. Here's a quick tip with respect to how you design access into your systems. You write a job description, and then you base the security around what that job description is. If you hired somebody to be an AP clerk, they probably don't need access to the bank statement. You know, they probably can just write checks, and then you have somebody else in the organization compare them. The best way that you can handle security in your organization is to use what we call role-based authentication. Don't think about the individual person. You think about the role that they provide, and then you build the security policies around what that person provides to the company. If you build it to the individual person, you run the risk of getting to know that person and then making less than stellar judgments about what security access they should have. It couldn't possibly be Steve. You know, he's a good guy. Again, I went to his kid's high school graduation. He would never steal or embezzle, you know, so let's just give him a little bit extra privileges or access because he says he needs them. No, you write the role, you write the security permissions around the role of that person to the company. So some sample controls here. Okay, a formal mechanism exists for providing new users with access to a system, including formally approving the user and establishing rights. Okay, how can you test this? Well, acquire and read a copy of the policy that applies to this, sample some of the new users, validate that their access was approved and aligned with what their job description is. I literally did this yesterday. We hired a new person in our company to work on our marketing team. And my business partner who handles all of this, I sent him the job description and he wrote the security policies around what that guy is supposed to do. And so, you know what? He gets access to Teams and SharePoint. He also gets access to our Adobe Creative Marketing Cloud. But you know what he doesn't get access to? He doesn't get access to the QuickBooks file or doesn't get access to Melio for payments. He doesn't get access to the bank or anything else like that. But you know what? If we hire a bookkeeper at some point or an accountant, we'll write another job role and we'll write the permissions unique to that person. Okay, whenever a team member leaves a organization, a formal process exists to disable this user's account. Unfortunately, this does not happen enough. Unfortunately, this is a major risk for a lot of organizations because, you know what, we have an onboarding process, but we don't have an exit process. And the second somebody leaves the company, the day that they are leaving the company, you terminate access immediately. Immediately. I cannot understate this enough. Anybody who is not an active user to the company, their access is removed, revoked the second they walk out the door. They should, for example, have their key cards removed, security codes changed, access to their email invalidated. It doesn't matter how well of terms they leave on. It's a risk to the organization because if they have access and they didn't secure their account originally, well, somebody else could easily gain access to the account as well. So when people leave, ensure that all access is revoked in a timely manner. The company has a strong password policy in place and all user accounts are in compliance. Well, get a copy of that and compare it against password meters to determine the password's overall strength. The good news is there are a number of tools, for example, that will do this for you automatically without having to decrease the security of the password. There are tools, for example, that allow us to scan a corporate database. Like if we were the IT people, we could determine what passwords are insecure and then what might need to be changed or considered. You know, so there are a number of really kind of cool tools that can do this for you. And you can also do this on your own as well. You know, one of the really kind of cool tools that are out there that I use pretty regularly and I would recommend that anybody use would be LastPass for managing user password and security. You know, this could be a great tool, for example, not only to produce really good secure passwords for your organization and for your personal life, but also as a great way of ensuring that you're always following good security practices. Here's an example from my demo account of LastPass. So if you're using LastPass, one of the things you've got over here is the security dashboard, okay? And from the security dashboard, we can see here that we have a password in risk. With the paid version of the account, I'll even show you all the passwords that either are duplicated or that are particularly low value that could easily be compromised, okay? there's no reason to not use a secure password these days because these tools like LastPass are fantastic for what they do. Okay, you can generate a secure password at any point. Right click, LastPass, generate secure password, and you can generate to your heart's content whatever type of password you want at whatever length you would want. You know, if I want to make a 27 or 35 or 45 character password, I can. And to put this into perspective, how long and how strong is that password? How long would it take to compromise? Well, there's a great website, howsecureismypassword.net. It will tell you. And so for that particular password, it would take 800 quadricillion years. I really don't know how long that is, but I'm willing to bet that I won't be around to see if and when that is cracked. So using a strong password, in my opinion, in today's environment is really just kind of a no-brainer. You should absolutely use one whenever possible. Okay, program changes. All changes to existing software systems are authorized, tested, approved, as well as documented. We just don't make haphazard changes based off of the specific wants and needs of individuals on whims. Okay, what's the risk if we don't do this? Well, we could have unauthorized changes that could cause issues, errors, or result in inaccurate data. Okay, well, what we do, we have change management. We ensure that any software updates, upgrades are approved to management before actually being implemented. Program development. All new systems and applications are authorized by IT and authorized by the corporate management. They're tested, they're approved, they're implemented and documented. One of my clients, who I will not say their name, they've got three different systems. They've got 365 for some users, Zoho for some users, and Google for some users. This company isn't big. They're like 50 people. You know, they don't have one standard system. I mean, it's really, really, really incredible. There's no oversight, you know, and I'm not saying that, you know, you absolutely need to have a massive IT team for everything that you do, but there should be some coordination, and management, for example, should take the lead on this. The risk here is that inappropriate access will lead to incomplete or inaccurate data, resulting in a data breach. So best way of handling this is coordination in the IT team for what you're going to do and how you're going to do it. For our computer operations, okay, computing assets are available and functioning as desired, as intended. Okay, what this really means is that we prioritize operational reliability for our organization and that we have stable computer operating systems that will work whenever we need them to work. Okay, what's the risk? Well, computing assets are not available or not performing as intended. So how can we figure this out? Monitoring, backup and recovery, patch management, updates, things of this nature are pretty easy to do. There are a ton of different companies and products that are out there that are really good for helping ensure that your computers maintain updates and being reliable. There's also tools that you can do there that you can provide that can tell you whether or not your computers are online or potentially having issues. One of my favorite tools that I use all the time is called Uptime Robot. Okay, uptimerobot.com. And it's a service that you can use to monitor your company's website, remote access servers, file server, whatever, and it'll monitor it all for you to ensure that they are essentially working. Okay. Now you can use this to create a nice little status page, like for CPE Today, our K2 company here. You can go to health.cpetoday and it'll show you that at the moment, all of our systems are operational. We can see that our API is 99s of up. Okay. Our shortened service is 100% up. The streaming service, almost 100% up. Likewise in here. But this is a great tool, for example, for monitoring the availability and status of your systems. And for the most part, it's free. And with many of these tools, you just actually have to do them, you know, and that's the hard part about it is actually getting people to actually do this. So some sample controls that you might want to consider with respect to your operational controls here. Okay. Jobs and applications are monitored to ensure that they are successfully completed. A good example of this would be like your backup service. In our company, we utilize CrashPlan for our company backup. Well, I get a report once a day that lets me know for all of my staff in the field whether or not their computers were backed up, and if so, when was the most recent backup and whether or not it completed. Well, I monitor it. And if I see, for example, Bob or Susan or Sherry or something like that, and their computer isn't backed up, well, you know what? I just give them a call and I say, hey, you know, are you having a problem? Is the computer offline? Is it working okay? And we just resolve it that way. And this kind of plays into the next one. All data is backed up and stored in the appropriate location. You know, we just want to monitor to ensure that that is occurring. There are processes in place for identifying, escalating, and resolving end-user technology problems. We just don't let these problems fester and wait. So a report from Warren Averett in 2016 lists, for example, the top 10 IT general control deficiencies here. And if we kind of go along with this, 40% of these items that are listed here are all associated with access risk. Terminated employees are still active. Shared accounts are out there without people monitoring them. Weak passwords, lack of tech backup for critical systems, and more. Frankly, folks, these are all very easily mitigatable risks. It does not take a long time to be able to put the proper systems in place here to ensure that, you know, you've mitigated these risks to acceptable levels. Terminated staff, whether they leave on their own or you make them leave, is simple. I mean, really, you just need to notify IT. And that's usually the part that doesn't happen is, you know, we're the last people to know often, and we're the last people to take care of that. And if you just tell your IT team ahead of time, they'll be more than happy to take care of that for you. Not sharing passwords, very simple thing. Don't share accounts. Buy the right number of licenses for what you need. But if it's something like a shared account, you know, we looked at earlier, for example, changing the check, you know. I went and I created a check to Steve Coe Industries, and then I changed it after the fact to somebody else. And you'll notice there was a login associated with it. Well, if we're sharing accounts, how are you ever going to be able to hold somebody accountable if money goes missing, data gets corrupted, something goes awry? Well, if everybody's using the same account, you're not going to be able to hold anybody accountable to it. So everybody gets separate accounts with no exceptions. You know, you always have separate accounts and you monitor those accounts to ensure they're not being shared. Test your backups. Backup is not expensive in today's environment. It does not take a lot to be able to do an effective backup plan. And man, it is not something you ever, ever, ever want to do after the fact because you can't recreate that data. The cost can be so astronomically high that, I mean, it could put you out of business. And it's so easy to overcome. Now, a great way of being able to deal with this is through policy, okay? A key component of effective general controls is policy making and enforcing policies uniformly from the CEO down to the intern and everybody in between. Every organization should maintain a set of well-documented policies reflective of the current operating environment of the company. And not only do these policies, for example, provide great insight, you know, and they also hold people accountable because now they know what the base level of operations that they're doing and what they're expected and what is expected of them. But then also they're a reference point for conducting evaluations later on. I mean, to go back to the client of mine that has three different productivity packages that utilizes two different cloud providers, you know, and that in and of itself isn't a horrible thing, but they've got two different sides of the company operating two different ways. I mean, how the heck am I supposed to evaluate this to figure out where the potential risks are? I mean, they're all over the place for that matter. Now, a great way of implementing policy inside your organization is to use the SANS Institute. Now, the SANS Institute is a longtime favorite of K2. We use a lot of their resources in our classes, and for good reason. They are a very effective organization for maintaining knowledge about security for your company. They provide a number of seminars and white papers and self-study and live in-person conferences about security. And they've got a ton of really cool tools from training resources all the way up to policy resources that you can use in your company. So a question you might ask yourself, like, Steve, how do I know what to do or where to do, or how am I going to get these policies in place? Well, I'm glad you asked. Head on over to sans.org. And on this particular website, you'll notice if you scroll down a little bit, you'll see this that says the free resources. Go ahead and click that person, that little guy right there. And if you scroll down a little bit more on the right-hand side, you'll see another option here that says security policy templates. And if you click that, this will take you into their directory of these policies. And they have probably close to 100, if not more, different security policies that you can choose to use on literally every topic that you could think of. I could not have made a better resource myself. All these policies are free. They are copyrighted, so you can't sell them. But like if you have a client that says, can you put together a corporate policy for security? Great. Come over here. You can grab anything you want and use it to your heart's content. So they have policies to cover all different sorts of general controls for your company. Everything from acceptable use, antivirus, forwarded email, clean desk, data breach, email, retention, extranet. There's just a ton of them. I don't even have time to read them all listed here. But you could put together a policy framework for your company reflective of your current operations. You know, so a good example of this might be your password policy. Okay, let's go ahead and check out this password protection. Now, the way these policies are listed, they're listed as either a PDF or a doc file. Now, PDF is just a straight up PDF. The doc file is a Microsoft Word file, and you can download that if you want to edit it. Let's just look at the PDF, make it simple today. And if you want, you can download this and download the doc file and edit to your heart's content. And you'll see throughout this document, it's kind of a Mad Libs thing. You'll see, this section where it says company name. Well, guess what? That's where you do a find and replace and put in your company name here. And so these policies are very well written. Okay, there's an overview section, the purpose, the scope, and then ultimately you come down here to the policy section. So for your password policy, okay, all user passwords have to be XYZ long, have to have XYZ complex things about them, how often they should be changed. You know, there's all these different components, how they have to be protected. Passwords must not be shared with anybody, including supervisors and coworkers. Must be treated as sensitive company information. But if you utilize policy, now you're able to keep people on the same page and you're able to hold people accountable to the specific policy of the company. It's such a wonderful thing to be able to say to people, this is our corporate policy. I mean, it's like a nice, I feel like Batman in a way. I've got my nice shield in front of me that I can say, oh, well, you know, I'd love to be able to help you so-and-so, but you know what? I'm sorry. It's our corporate policy to make passwords this long and this complex, you know? And it often takes a very specific type of writer to kind of come up with these policies. It's certainly not engaging writing, but I'm so thankful for the security professionals and I'm sure lawyers that got involved to make this a wonderful resource for the rest of us. So check out sans.org, great resource for you. Okay, so in our next section, let's talk about IT application controls. So general controls are the basis of foundation for our tech. Application controls give us the ability to be able to provide security and authentication and internal controls around the actual software applications that we're using themselves. And so it's around things like data entry, the ability to process, and then also the outputs that come from these different systems. Now, application security controls can also include things like the actual data itself, editing, segregation of business functions, so segregation of duties, for example, who can initiate a transaction versus authorize versus reconcile, balancing process totals, batch processing, reporting, so on and so forth. Now, our application controls here are applied at the user, the application, and the business process level. In contrast to our general controls, which are only applied at a really kind of high level, you know, like the network, you know, and the password policy is the password policy, you know, versus the the application controls. Well, what are the specific needs of the specific application that we're working with? So to illustrate this concept, general controls might be applied to allow a user to sign on to a network and even control which apps the user can access. But the application control would be what rights does the user have to that specific application, or what rights do they have to access specific reports? So one would be my login to Windows. One would be my password requirement for my cell phone. And the other would be, well, what can I do in this app itself? You know, let's say for your example, your organization uses Office 365 and you also use, let's say, you know, a paperless solution of some sort. Well, the general control would be who has access to 365, who has an email account, what access levels do you have with respect to 365 to access your email or your calendaring or whatever else you might have. But the access application control would be rather for that paperless solution. Well, what clients can you access? Can you edit their files? Can you delete client files? Things of this nature, you know, or if you're working in an accounting solution for this matter, what functional areas of the accounting solution can you access? Can you enter transactions? Can you edit transactions? Can you delete transactions? Maybe we cut off whole areas of the application. So maybe you can't access accounts receivable, or you can't access accounts payable, or maybe payroll records. Okay. So general controls, macro level; application controls, micro level. So here's some examples of different application controls and their purpose. So we have authentication. Well, what's the purpose? To validate that that person has the rights to the data that they're authorized to do. You know, that they have an account to QuickBooks so that they can log in. We have authorization controls to validate that the person doing the transaction is authorized to do so. We have completeness checks to validate that what they're doing meets the specific criteria for what that specific data type is required to do. Like, for example, setting up a client, you know, if we have first name and last name, you can't set up a client unless you have both of those. Well, that client doesn't get set up. So we can do a completeness check on it. Sometimes we refer to that as data validation. And again, a great way of helping reduce risk and exposure is just to build good software to begin with. And when you're building stuff, you try to think about the different ways people are going to screw it up and, you know, force them to not let them screw it up. And, you know, in this case, maybe building very simple validation checks like that could cause prevent a client from creating a huge issue down the road. We have forensic controls to detect whether the inappropriate transaction has occurred. A good example of that would be our audit log. Our audit log is a great forensic control, you know, whether the client likes it or not, or sorry, not the client, but the employee likes it or not. I mean, everything they do is getting logged by the system, and I can go check that at any point. Okay, we have input controls to ensure that the data is valid itself. So lots of opportunities. So here's some examples, some practical examples of our application controls. Username and passwords of applications are required, you know, so you can't just access the accounting system, the CRM solution, or other line of business. I have a client who has a very, very old Access database that they use to run their inventory system with. And it's funny, when you load up the inventory solution, it prompts you for a password and it will literally take any value you put in there. That's what they thought would be a good deterring control. You know, I remember talking with their IT person and he's like, no, it accepts a password. And I literally smashed the keyboard and it let it in, you know? So I can't rely on that system. You know, if it spits out a report for inventory, I can't rely on that. And so, you know, if they were a publicly held company, which they're not, you know, they would have to do some sort of periodic, count of their inventory to ensure that it is still accurate because the system could easily be overridden. Specific rights are granted within the application and the user can and cannot access, preferably by role-based authentication. As we mentioned, role-based authentication, we take the job description of that person, we write a role, and then we associate the person to the role. I know that sounds like a subtle distinction, but it's very powerful. It's one of those things that, like, once you understand the power of writing authentication based off of a role rather than a person, it becomes a lot easier to make good security decisions for your company. If you always base it around individuals, people come and go from a company, you know, and you're going to have another person in that role in the future. If you base it off of the role of that person, as people come and go, get promoted, demoted, moved out, whatever, Well, you're providing consistent access to that person in that role. And that's really, really powerful. And it's a great security technique. Edits on fields to ensure proper type of data is being entered. No text in a date field. Again, that goes back to data validation and preferably good software design. Audit trail reports show who did what and when they did it. Absolutely. I'm a huge fan of audit trail reports. We build them in every application that we do, not only for forensics, but then also for troubleshooting. You know, I've had plenty of clients make a huge problem with their applications that we build for them. And, you know, we need the way to be able to decouple, you know, all the different commits and changes that they made. Well, if we have a log of those transactions, we can always play it in reverse and figure out where the issue started and unwind that ball of yarn. In our next section here, let's go ahead and analyze and evaluate our different technology controls. And to do this, what we want to do is we want to consider the risks that are inherent that if we don't have these control environments properly set up, what that could potentially cause for us. Now, when considering the need for general controls or application controls, a risk analysis should be performed to determine the breadth and depth of the control environment. And so we want to ask ourselves a bunch of different questions to determine how far and how wide we want to take this. Okay, like what IT assets are at risk? What's their value in terms of confidentiality, integrity, and availability? Okay, what could happen if we, for example, don't do something correct? And what could happen to the value of that data? Could it cause an issue with confidentiality, integrity, or availability, interrupting the company's ability to earn revenue? What could happen if that asset is threatened or compromised? What could that impact be? You know, how could that threat materialize? Could it, for example, be a horrible news story that could, you know, cause reputation damage to our company? Could it, for example, be and result in regulatory fines? Who knows? You know, I like to think about the IT team that worked at Equifax in 2017. I like to think about that second they realized what had happened with their servers that resulted in the largest data breach and the most serious data breach of all time. I like to think a guy like or a gal just sat back from their keyboard and was like, oh my, like, oh man, what am I going to do here? You know, I don't think they would have thought of that it would ultimately result in the firing of literally the whole board of directors and the CEO and in congressional hearings, you know. But some threats can be minor, some threats can be major, but no matter what, a breach of some sort will cause reputation damage, and that should be a very serious consideration for the company. And what can be done to address the risk? Is it cost effective? You cannot eliminate risk ever. You know, you can only hope to mitigate it to a more acceptable level. And depending on the nature of what you're trying to do, that can be very expensive. You know, some risks, in order to be able to mitigate them to an acceptable level, costs millions of dollars. You know, ideally you get it right the first time and you design systems where you can do this with relative ease, but that doesn't always happen. Also, it can be very expensive after the fact to try to retrofit existing systems to be more secure. Sometimes that's not even possible. I've worked on a number of projects over the years where a company has their application, they're happy with their application, you know, and they just want to update it. And it's like, hey, I'm really sorry. I mean, this is built on a house of cards here. In order to be able to implement, let's say, encryption at the database, well, we have to rewrite the whole application because it doesn't support that. It's not a matter of, you know, changing out one thing. Often with computer systems, you're dealing with a house on stilts. You know, you pull out the wrong stilt, that whole thing is going to come crumbling down. Here's an example of a process that you could use for evaluating controls: conducting a risk assessment, identifying the different applications in use, creating a catalog, testing, evaluating, and reporting. Now, unfortunately, due to time, I'm not going to have an opportunity to go through this, but I will point out that throughout the material, we've got some really good insight with respect to how you would evaluate these different controls and why each of these steps are valid and some of the specific circumstances that you can do to implement that in your organization and how to build that process up. Okay, in our next section, let's just spend a few minutes and talk about some of the cool tech stuff that's out there to assist with helping detect and prevent fraud. And there is some really compelling things in and around artificial intelligence. So AI is incredible. I will point out that all this AI that we see at the moment, you know, whether it be the Google Alexa devices or Siri or whatever else, Google Home and more, these are all what we call narrow focus AI. They're really good at one thing. You know, despite the fact that Alexa can answer just about any question I can think of, it can turn off and on my lights. It's actually quite simple with respect to what it does. It's just a simple knowledge-based thing. I ask it a question, it's got some knowledge, it returns that response. It's a trigger and action tool in a lot of respects. It just does what I tell it to do, you know. But AI is so much more than that. And the value chain is continuing to grow. There's more and more and more that's popping up here that really can add a tremendous amount of value to the organization. And one of the things that it does is that it's 24/7, 365. It is not biased, you know, for the most part. I mean, it doesn't bring in personal bias on things. You program it to do something, it does exactly what you tell it to do 100% of the time. It'll never take a day off and it'll never call in sick. And there are a number of really good AI tools where the opportunity to be able to analyze far exceeds what we personally could do in our own life. Okay. And there are increasingly becoming more tools available that are AI driven that can really do some cool stuff. And with this, it's a force multiplier, probably bigger than anything else that we could normally do. With AI tools, the opportunity to analyze the sheer quantity of data in pretty much real time really helps reduce the risk of fraud to a very, very acceptable level. Consider this, for example. Forbes estimate that losses could exceed $12 billion from fraud. Okay? So, I mean, that's pretty incredible. And that's just credit card fraud, $12 billion. I'm guessing all of us at some point have gotten that phone call from Chase or from Citibank or Bank of America, whomever we happen to have our credit card, asking us if we just bought a pair of Nikes in São Paulo, Brazil, or if we actually were eating dinner in Istanbul or something. Well, somehow somebody got our credit card and was able to fraudulently charge it. Now, they've gotten much, 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 much better over the years, but it's still not perfect. These AI tools are now being used by a lot of different banks and processors to reduce the rate of credit card fraud and bring it more acceptable levels. So one such example is Eno from Capital One. Okay, Eno or Eno, I'm not exactly sure how you pronounce it, is Capital One's AI-powered virtual assistant. It is used to spot transactions that are not in line with the customer's normal purchasing habits that would otherwise seem suspicious. And if it spots something that is suspicious, it sends a message to the customer asking if they are aware of the transaction. It then analyzes the response and continues to look for any deception, and then will adjust accordingly. And every credit card transaction it gets for you is better and better. You know, most of the credit card companies have something like this. Amex certainly does. Citibank certainly does. The Fair Isaac Corporation, FICO, this is what their big thing is these days, is analyzing credit card transactions for fraudulent purposes. Now, AI isn't just one thing. It's a lot of different things. It's a lot of technology, everything from big data and data warehousing and data lakes, natural language processing, deep learning, machine learning. All of it is kind of converging in and around to create these AI systems that can really do a lot for helping identify risk and better mitigate it. And so AI in general is kind of the way that we would interpret this data and then ultimately make a decision. Using AI, we can automate a lot of the more mundane tasks like checking particular balances, checking for instances of fraud, you know, and it can really do a lot for us. According to Accenture, AI has boosted the capability of productivity by nearly 40%, and that's what they're estimating over the next 15 years. Now, there's some pretty cool building blocks of AI. Okay, I already mentioned a few of these. We have computer vision. Computers can see and understand scanning a check on a mobile app or facial recognition for login. You know, Windows Hello, for the most part, that's a great example of computer vision. Sees you. Yep, that's you. Let you in. I can't speak to Windows Hello, but I know for Face ID, part of the iPhone and iPad authentication protocol. I think it uses something around like 60 different measurements on the face, like the distance from the eye to the nose, the distance from here to here, and other things like that to identify who you are, even if you're wearing like glasses for that matter. Okay. And computers are getting increasingly better at being able to pick out people from a crowd and identifying who they are. Another example of that comes to mind. There is a group in Las Vegas. I want to say it's the Plymouth Group. I think it's something like that. But they have an AI algorithm to detect cheats in Vegas. You know, so Las Vegas has probably a million security cameras around town. All the big casinos certainly have them everywhere. You know, you couldn't have enough people, for example, watching those cameras to find potential issues. But you know what you can do? You can use AI. In this group, they make an AI algorithm that can identify people and players. And they can identify players not only for, you know, nefarious purposes, identifying cheats for that matter, but they can also use it to identify top players. So that like when you go to a casino, you know, the casino host knows to come out and greet you because you are one of their A-star one players. And it's able to do this not only with a camera, but sometimes thousands of cameras concurrently. We have machine learning. Machine learning is the ability for the computer to recognize patterns from previous experiences. For example, identifying junk mail in your Outlook and filtering out stuff like that that matches that pattern in the future. Now, with machine learning, we have to give it a pattern. We teach it the pattern. You know, it's like kind of training your dog to, you know, walk off leash or bark on command or something. We give it an example and then we reinforce the example through additional experiences. We have deep learning, which is exactly like that, except it's a lot more complicated. It's essentially a black box and the computer comes up with its own patterns. You know, we give it a outcome, it figures out how to get there. So we give it A, we tell it we want C, it figures out B on its own. And then if you really want to go further out there, you got this thing called neural networks, which honestly is even more esoteric and even more complex. But it's like a deep learning algorithm on steroids where, you know, it can evaluate multiple independent criteria of each other to come to a conclusion in the same way that your brain can look at 20 different criteria and come out with a conclusion on of its own. Like it's not one thing that leads to answer one, you know, it's like 50 things that lead to answer one. You know, like how do you come up with the price of selling a house? Well, I mean, it's not just one thing. It's the square footage, it's the neighborhood, comparable properties in the area selling. It could be whether or not the home is in disrepair or what condition, interest rates. I mean, there's so many different things that you can consider here. We also have semantic analysis, assigning logic. We have natural language processing, one of my personal favorites. This is the ability for humans and computers to be able to talk to each other and be able to share information. Point of this, it's there's a lot of tech that's making this possible. And it's not just about using AI for fraud detection. You can use AI for just about anything. You know, AI can be incredibly helpful and assistive in performing a wide range of tasks to the accountant and financial professional. I mean, I use AI for a bunch of different things inside of our company. I use automation for a bunch of different things inside of our company as well. And I'm able to do that through the foundational work of, again, machine learning, deep learning, natural language processing, and other things like that. Now, we're going to increasingly see more and more AI tools, you know, come into play. But let's go ahead and talk, for example, about how AI can reduce expenditure fraud. So AI would allow you to audit 100% of all transactions. It can help you identify fraudulent information. It can help you to identify mistakes and catch them before they become a problem. You can use it to train a model that can audit transactions before you actually pay them to ensure that what you're paying is correct. AI can electronically match invoices for you, such as purchase orders or receiving reports, so you don't rely upon, you know, Steve doing his job correct. A good example of this that comes to mind, one of my clients, they use the tool Expensify for employee expense reimbursement. In my opinion, and I've looked at them all, Expensify is by far the best tool for a lot of different reasons. It's the simplest, it's the easiest, and the AI tools built into it are fantastic. You submit a receipt that doesn't meet company policy, it'll get rejected. It'll tell you it'll get rejected and why. It has optical character recognition that it could scan a receipt, pull out the actual line items of that receipt, and properly categorize it according to that company's policy. Not only does that a lifesaver with respect to data entry, but also from a fraud perspective, because, you know, if it doesn't meet the criteria, it's rejected and kicked out. Now, as great as it is, I will tell you, the bane of any technology is the people that use it. So we still run into issues where, despite the technology being really sophisticated, the users maybe aren't on the same page. We could use AI to improve compliance. We can identify, for example, things that are over the limit. We can identify where expense reports don't jive with the receipt. Again, one of the cool things with Expensify is that it integrates with all the major credit card companies, including American Express, Capital One, Bank of America, and others, where for the staff of that client, okay, let's say they go out to, you know, for a dinner for that matter. Well, they will take a copy of the receipt with their phone. And then the service is integrated in with American Express, which is the company's provider. It will automatically match that receipt to the Amex charge. And if it doesn't match, well, then it'll throw exceptions and then somebody can manually review it and determine if it is correct or not. But, you know, it takes the employee out of the equation. You know, the system basically does, I'm going to say, about 80% of the work so that the corporate staff of that client doesn't have to. It can recognize when personal payment cards are used instead of corporate cards. It can identify meal costs over daily limits. It can recognize when two people submit the same receipt. I mean, it's pretty cool, you know, with what it can do. And Expensify does all of that for the most part. AI can help improve the expenditure process. It can detect duplicate payments before they occur. It can scour the internet to ensure that you're paying a competitive price for products and services before you purchase them to help reduce things like collusion, where you have a purchasing agent maybe not working to get the best deal from a vendor, or maybe they're buying from their neighbor's cousin kind of a thing and not getting the best price. AI can verify that appropriate discount terms are being applied, you know, that somebody's just not letting inventory walk out the front door. AI can help verify that consulting services are helping you actually in your organization, helping you that ensure that you're paying for a fee and for a service where it's actually being performed. It can also help you pay the right amount for your licensing. You know, there's so many different SaaS-based providers now, and how do you know that you're actually getting value off the different services that you have? Now, you may have access to some AI tools now. Okay, AI is appearing just about everywhere, and there's a lot of AI built into common day applications that might be available to you that you just might not realize. For example, inside of Office 365, if you're a subscriber, you have Microsoft Excel. Well, there's a tool inside of Excel called Ideas, which is an AI tool. With Ideas, Microsoft will analyze your data and alert you to trends and patterns that you might not otherwise notice. So over here, what we see is an example of a spreadsheet, and we would go up to the Home tab, and on the far right, we would see the Ideas button there. We click it, and what this tool is going to do is it's going to analyze this spreadsheet, and it's going to give you some examples of charts and graphs and pivot tables that might help you identify trends in your company. So I'm going to say right now, this is kind of infant. I mean, I don't want to get everybody's hopes up. It's okay. You know, it's nothing beyond real basic stuff. But, you know, I applaud the effort, and I applaud with where this could potentially be going in the future. Now, the AI CPA also has a audit data analytics initiative as well. So they've got this thing called the Audit Data Standard. It's a working group to develop standards and data models to facilitate data analytics for auditing. They've got a couple of different standard documents they put out there, their base standard, their general ledger standard, and order to cash sub-ledger standard. And the idea behind this is that you can take a common data format and then it becomes really easy to be able to audit those statements because it is all repeatable and refreshable. And there's no difference between client one and client two. The actual output of the document is the same. And so they've also published what they call their guide to audit data analytics. And this guide is really kind of intended to encourage auditors to make better use of analytics during the audit. And it's pretty cool in terms of where it comes. The AICPA actually has a whole like analytics thing now, which is pretty interesting, that if you have any interest in learning Python, which is a programming language, they've got a whole series of stuff in a white paper that you can use to learn a little bit more about how to do programming and how the data standards can be justified and evaluated using programming languages. So here is the website. I'll go ahead and drop this in here. And so here are the audit standards provided by the AICPA. So they've got their base standard, their general ledger standard, and so on. And if you just kind of click through here, they've got some really interesting information about this particular standard and how you would choose to apply that particular standard. And then here, let me come over here. Okay, this, the data standard and audit data analytics. This is also a really good white paper talking about how you can use statistical sampling with Python for a financial statement. And again, it's a really nice introductory to programming from a financial professional's perspective. You might find some pretty good use out of this particular tool. Okay, we're just about to the end of our presentation here. And let me just go ahead and summarize AI real quick, and then I'm going to leave you with the American Certified Fraud Examiner's benchmarking report for you to kind of consider as well with some closing thoughts. What I will leave you with respect to AI, we're not there yet, but we're clearly moving in a direction of travel, and data analytics and artificial intelligence, machine learning, the possibilities of these tools are really incredible. And I'm so optimistic about with where this will help and the not only benefit for our organizations for improving compliance, but just surely how much this is going to improve our lives and make things easier. AI and other emerging technologies like it are going to be fantastic for fraud prevention in the future and hopefully just make us all a little bit more secure. Now, the last thing I want to mention to you is the Anti-Fraud Technology Benchmarking Report. This was published in 2019 by the Association of Certified Fraud Examiners in partnership with SAS, or the SAS Institute out of North Carolina. It's a pretty cool report that encapsulates responses from a survey that went out to a ton of financial professionals and forensic analysts and specialists. And it was discussing how technology is kind of a double-edged sword with respect to fraud. It provides opportunities to commit fraud, but it also gives us the tools to combat fraud. And the report seeks to identify those technologies which will help mitigate fraud risk and provide positive return on investment. Now, a couple takeaways from this. Relatively few organizations really leverage their data effectively. They're, for example, maybe doing some structured data analysis, but there is a whole ocean of unstructured data in your company. For example, for like metadata for phone calls and other communications and emails and other stuff that you can use to data mine to help infer whether or not fraud is occurring. And it's kind of the takeaway from this talks about some of the ways that some organizations are combating this inside their company. But you might find, for example, get some insight with how some organizations are doing this, whether it be, for example, using digital forensic software and discovery software, using evidence gathering software. You know, it's a pretty cool report. And if you get a chance, you should download it and definitely take a look. Colleagues, welcome back. Let's go ahead and wrap up our presentation today with some review questions to reinforce what we've learned about in our talk for today on case studies and avoiding fraud. All right, our first question, which of the following would represent an example of information technology general controls? Okay, so what would it be? Would it be controls over the software acquisition, deployments, and updates? Absolutely, that would be a good example of a general control. Controlling how that information and those software solutions, platforms, and tools get their way in, that's always a good thing for business. Controls over hardware, software configuration deployment. Absolutely. Same vein. You want to have tight controls over what gets into your organization, how it's set up, configured, and secured. Controls over physical, logical access to systems, networks, applications, and data. Absolutely. These are all really good things here. The correct answer here is all of the above, especially in this new work from anywhere environment with people working really from anywhere now that we live in this COVID world. We need to have tight controls over this because we don't have control necessarily over the physical place of where work is conducted like we did just even a couple of years ago. All right, our next review question. Which of the following represents a form of integrity risk when assessing the risk associated with information technology general controls? Okay, so integrity risk, what would that be? Number of users on a system? No, that wouldn't be it, you know, because I mean, ideally you build systems that can scale pretty large. Number of administrative users on a system? That sounds pretty good, actually. Yeah, you know, ideally we want to restrict the number of administrative users that we might have to only those who critically need that level of permission. Because remember, administrators can do anything. So we want to limit who has that ability whenever possible. Whether systems are developed in-house or not, as a software developer myself, I could tell you, you should not fear in-house systems, although they do require a little bit different care and consideration, but in a lot of ways, it can be more beneficial to a business than not. So that's not an integrity risk. And so I would say the correct answer here, again, is going to be number of administrators on the system. You want to restrict that whenever possible. Our third reviewing question, which of the following would represent a test of effectiveness when evaluating information technology general controls and application controls? So what would be a test of effectiveness? Determining that the control is designed properly to prevent or detect errors and frauds. I mean, that's great, but it's kind of hard. I mean, that's a reflective thing. You can't really always tell if it did the thing you intended it to do. So that's probably not the exact answer. Is it determining that the cost or the control is cost effective? That's not really in the scope of effectiveness. Ideally, you know, you want to build controls that are reasonably priced, but you know, there's always this trade-off between strength of control and cost and complexity. I mean, you can always you can never eliminate fraud, but you can make it less and less likely. It just becomes more and more expensive, more costly, and more difficult to implement. So I would say for a test of effectiveness, the correct answer here would be determining that the control is operating as expected. Well, that does bring us to the end of our presentation and the end of this series. I'm sure we'll revisit this land at some point in the future. In this class and today, what we learned, we defined what these general controls were, as well as taking a deep look on application controls and kind of understanding the differences between them. We talked about the different ways key information technology controls work and how they operate, where control failures exist, where weaknesses can exist, and how that can lead to fraud. And I gave you as many recommendations as I could think of for preventing fraud and improving internal controls in your environment. Well, folks, as always, you can earn credit for watching or listening to what you listened to or watched today. Head on over to cpetoday.com. Today's course code is CSF4, CSF4. You can watch this presentation again, as well as the three preceding versions of this course. You know, there have been 4 hours of this particular content. So if you like it and you want some more Steve in your life, you can check out the other three and get a total of 4 credits. How cool is that? So again, cpetoday.com. If you like our content, you like our channel, you like what we're doing here, please consider connecting with us on social media. You can find us on almost every social media network at CPE Today. Follow us on Facebook, like us on YouTube, so on and so forth. That stuff really helps spread the word about the channel and get more people interested in the content that we are producing. Our podcast is produced live twice a week by our team. We come to you on cpetoday.com as well as YouTube and Facebook. You can always watch live and ask questions. How cool is that? And if you can't watch live, you can also get us on your own time. You can subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you happen to get content. Please consider leaving a review. That really helps, again, spread the news about what we're doing here. Thank you so much for your time and attention, folks. I hope you have a great rest of your day, and I'll see you back in the office the next time around. Take care.